Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and we are continuing to talk about how recruiting works, this time with Maryland head coach John Tillman. Coach Tillman, thank you so much for joining us. Really excited for this conversation. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
No doubt. So we recorded mid-August, and obviously that means that we're roughly halfway between when you and your staff have just spent 60 days on sidelines, in the heat, sunscreen in the eyes, all the miserable stuff that we're used to. And then, you know, you've got another, you know, kind of 15 to 18 days before you start making phone calls, sending texts and emails, and hosting guys on campus. How do you describe this moment in time? What are you and your staff trying to get done?
Yeah, I think, you know, once kind of the last events or the dead period, you know, that was approaching and a lot of the big events were ending, you know, I think it was important for, you know, everybody to catch their breath and then make sure that, you know, the staff was able to get some vacation. And if they haven't done it, do it now, and at least get that mental break. And then I think, like any staff, circle back. Our players come back next Friday. So you can kind of sense that summer is over, fall is coming, and then you're really thinking about, all right, what's our plan going forward on so many levels involving so many things, including recruiting, and then kind of catch up with the staff and start kind of just, you know, all right, what did you see this summer? Let's do a deep dive here on our thoughts coming out of it. And then, you know, kind of banter back and forth and exchange ideas and thoughts and things of that nature.
So I wasn't going to ask this, but you brought it up and I think it's kind of interesting. How do you balance the need for rest and recovery? I would imagine that it's a kind of a similar approach that you take to your team. Like, you and your staff need to rest. You need to recover in order to be sharp, to be efficient and effective at doing your job. But at the same time, I would imagine that there's this, you know, kind of compulsion for urgency where it's like, you know, everything's fresh in our brains. Like, we got to get it down on paper to make sure we didn't forget anything. How do you balance that?
We have a great staff, really bright guys. I have a lot of faith in those guys. So my feeling is they'll write down the things they need to write down. And you're right. Like, the balance is really important. We don't do a lot of mandatory things on campus during the summer. There'll be times where we're all in, and there'll be times where we'll meet, but given how much we're on the road in the summer, but also given the commitment level of the fall and the spring, you know, we're working a lot. So I do think it's important for guys to have balance in their lives and spend time with their family. I think we learned a lot during COVID in terms of using Zoom and being able to meet virtually. So that takes a lot of pressure off. Hey, we got to go into the office and meet just to meet. I think, you know, you're able to, we have a really veteran group of guys I trust and I value their opinion. So we can do a lot of that virtually. We can do calls together. So I didn't really feel like we needed to like meet immediately. I think it was really important for guys to do the things that they wanted to do and then be excited about coming back. And I think if the guys feel overworked, your players are going to feel that. If they don't feel like they get a break, then they're going to be tired. And I want our guys excited to be back, not feeling obligated like, man, I got to be in the office all day long. We got to be efficient. We got to be smart. We're already asking a lot from our families right now.
So that kind of naturally sets up this question, because a huge part of how much you have to recover is a reflection on how onerous what you just did was. And I think that you can take a negative view on what is required from being at events, but I don't know that that's necessarily the way everybody feels, especially you. I think you have a reputation among your peers for enjoying it and being as committed as anybody else. Is that a fair reputation? And another way to ask it is, do you love evaluating?
I don't know. I think there are a lot of guys that work really hard. I think, you know, you're the person at the end of the day, whether it's how you coach your players, what you're doing in terms of your job, that has to look yourself in the mirror and feel like, did I do a good job today? Am I upholding the standard that needs to be set? We ask a lot of our staff. We ask a lot of our support staff, not just our coaches. We ask a lot of our players. So I think internally there's a certain expectation you have of yourself to lead from the front and not ask anybody to do something you're not willing to do yourself. I do enjoy so much of this profession, the relationships that you create, the teaching aspect, the breaking down of the film, teaching guys just technique, recruiting, being on the road. I think there's a certain, you know, amount that maybe is too much, but I do think getting on the road, going to places that you're familiar with, seeing some of your peers on the road, maybe grabbing dinner with either other coaches or, you know, the banter on the sideline sometimes is enjoyable and fun. And so you enjoy that part of it. I do feel like there's a lot, it's a lot right now. There was a survey that went out talking about, do we do anything differently in terms of maybe having a longer dead period, or putting some more parameters in. We'll probably find out more about the results of that in December with the coaches meetings down in Florida. So I'm not sure where that'll go. I do think that when we put that dead period in from July 2nd to the 6th a while back, you know, there was a fight to do it. And I think there was a lot of pushback. I don't think you're getting much pushback from anybody anymore, whether it's the coaches or the players. I think that break is definitely needed. It just seemed like June was a whirlwind, just tons of events and a lot of places to be. I felt like everybody was pretty exhausted when July 2nd hit.
So I want to come back to the banter topic because I was talking with one of your rivals and he made a comment to me that I'll share when I frame that question that has stuck with me over the course of the last month or so since he said it. But with that being said, a little bit more on what you try to accomplish when you're watching. And I know that it depends on the time of the summer. It depends on the team that you're watching, the event. I guess, how do you characterize the funnel? And what I mean by that is, early on, it is, I want to get eyes on as many players as possible. And then as we move forward, I can effectively eliminate guys. So now we go from, let's just call it, like, from a round number stake, 500 on June 1st. So then we get to 250 by July 1st. And then, you know, the goal is to get to 50 to 75. And so as a result, over the course of the intervening amount of time, we want to, you know, figure out why are the 175 that, you know, cross the first threshold not going to cross the second. And so now you're watching somebody for a third, fourth, maybe even a fifth time. How does that work for you, and what is your personal approach to the difference between, I call it, hunting with a shotgun versus hunting with a rifle?
Yeah, I think good question, and I'll add kind of another aspect of this too is, you know, you're this summer looking at the guys and evaluating the guys you can call at for the first time September 1st, I would add in one more element, which is watching the guys that are committed to you, because those guys, you know, are committed, but that's all they are. So I do think you have to not only get out there, and to your point, you're getting like eyeballs on so many guys, and then there becomes this funneling process. And I wouldn't even say eliminate guys, because I want anybody that listens to this, if you're a player or parent or family, to know that there are guys that maybe are farther ahead, but we realize you're human beings and some guys develop later. So there are a lot of guys. Rob Pinnell was one of them. I think Ajax Zapatello was another guy that was a bit of a late bloomer, that they were there. They just, like, they maybe physically, whether it's physically or just skill-wise, hadn't fully developed. And I think we all realized, because when we recruited the younger players and we could recruit eighth graders, we made so many mistakes, and on all sides. And so we realized that there will be guys that will develop late. You want to see how your guys are progressing. And I think showing up and showing your support for them is important. And that means that you've got to balance that with what you talked about. So now you have two classes that you're really working on. You're trying to make sure you get eyeballs at as many good events as possible. And there's so many really good events. We also realize they're human beings in terms of guys, like, I think we try to get data points. And I think none of us as college coaches in any sport like to be impulse shoppers. So you're trying to watch guys as many times as possible, realizing there'll be quarters or parts of quarters or halves or games where they're just not going to play well. And that does not make or break you. And I tell anybody that will listen, if you don't start the game well, say you're a faceoff guy and you lose the first three or four, if you can just hang in there and turn that around and really play well the rest of the game, you as a coach look at that so much more significantly than just how many percentage-wise you got. You were not doing well, you didn't tank it, and you responded really well. And you could use the same example for a goalie or a guy shooting or maybe defending. So there's kind of the statistic part of it of how they did. But also, you know, when things got a little dicey, if they responded well, those are things that a lot of people don't think about, certainly players and families. But we want to see you struggle a little bit to see how you deal with the struggle. Because at the college level, right, there'll be bad days. Like, they just will be. And if you can show us that you really don't flinch, that is a huge feather in your cap. And I think sometimes people are like, they're feeling so much pressure that every time they go out, they have to play at an A-plus level. And we'll see enough where there'll be a body of work and there's probably some ups and downs. But man, if we can see that resiliency, we can see maybe you're not playing well, but you're smart enough to go, all right, I'm not shooting my shot well, but maybe I'll distribute more. I'll pick up more ground balls. I'll just, you know, try to do other things to help the team win. I think that's huge. And you kind of saw that, you know, with the USA basketball team the other day. You had all these really good players and you had guys filling roles, whether it was great players on the bench or a guy like LeBron James that, listen, everybody was smart enough to just get the ball to Steph Curry. And everybody put their egos aside and said, this guy's super hot, get him the ball. And to me, that is a great lesson for all of us. Like, sometimes you just got to look and go, he's feeling it. And I'm going to be smart enough to get that guy that ball. Those are things that you can evaluate as a coach and realize, hey, if you're not doing one thing well, do other things well and play to your strengths that day. And we know they're human beings. We know you're not going to be perfect. So I want kids to love the game. And I know that there's some anxiety and there's only so many homes and a lot of guys are aspiring to a lot of the same places. But I feel like you can have a great experience at any school, at any level. And they will find you. We will find you. And our job is to find you. But we also don't expect you to be perfect. We want you to love the game. So go out and play because you love to play. I know sometimes that is hard because there's an end goal in mind. We get it. But, man, the more you can think about just playing for your teammates and your team and trying to help the team win and playing because you love it, I think you're just going to play better. So I think, you know, kind of circling back with, you know, the beginning of the summer, I think most people will kind of see who's out there. And then, you know, maybe when you have that break in July, you know, you meet as a staff, you start talking about certain guys, and then you kind of go back out again and try to see guys again to make sure that you're like, all right, let's confirm maybe some of our thoughts of where these guys are right now. And by the end of the summer, you kind of have to say, all right, where are we going to start? And I do think that is important, is where do we start? Because some of the best players in every class are guys that did blossom late. So in my opinion, I think it's a bit foolish to just say, hey, we're going to close up shop as quickly after September 1st as possible. Because I do think we all learned that if you do that, there are a lot of guys that are going to blossom late and you kind of miss the window on those guys.
So this is kind of in the vein of what you were just talking about. And I understand that it's a spectrum, but we all believe in a constraints-led approach. So I'm going to constrain you to one or the other. Do you tend to focus more on what a guy can do or what a guy can't do?
Well, you know, when you're talking about guys that have only played 2 years of high school, I'm hesitant to define something guys can't do. I'm more concerned about what are they doing right now. I think you know, when you start recruiting, you'll have more conversations with them and kind of get a sense of their approach. You might find out a little bit more about maybe what they want to do, what they're excited about doing. Do they have a growth mindset or do they have a fixed mindset? Are they a lifetime learner? You know, and usually those guys are the guys that are the best. You know, they don't want to be constrained to what they are right now. They want to keep getting better. So I think, again, I hesitate because I've seen so many guys improve and get better. I just think you're kind of evaluating them. Let's say they're 16 or 17. Like, okay, this is what they do well right now. I think, you know, you can get some feedback, obviously, talking to people who they know in terms of, you know, their approach to things. And that may be able to help you kind of figure out what their potential is. But really, it lies a lot of times inside each of us. Like, how hard do these guys want to work? What do they want to put into it? And how uncomfortable are they willing to get to try to get better? So I think that's I think you're going to back to your question, kind of look at what they do well right now and then try to figure out maybe their strengths are here. Can in those other areas, is there room for improvement or is this kind of their ceiling? And maybe it is their ceiling. I would have a tough time, though, pegging a guy at 16, 17 in terms of how good they can be without even, you know, getting to know them a little bit more. So I think you're going to build on the things they're doing well currently and then hopefully realizing that, man, this guy really wants to be coached and coached hard and pushed and challenged to see how much better they can get.
Yeah. So what you're kind of saying is that, you know, you spend June and July maybe getting to 50% of an evaluation, and then you spend September and October getting to know them, and that can fill in that gap. You can't tell from the sideline whether or not a player wants to be coached. I mean, you can, but not to the extent that you need to in order to make a decision like the ones that you're going to have to make on who you're bringing into the program.
Yeah, I think sometimes there's a misconception that, you know, we just watch a half of lacrosse and we're like, okay, we want that guy. You know, oh, that's our guy. I think this is a process. And again, most guys are going to put in a lot of different evaluations. Again, knowing there are some ups and downs and sometimes they're going to play better. But you also, the more you see them, the more you get to see the diversity of their skill set. You know, did they do one thing one game? Did they do something else another game? Again, we talked about responding to adversity. But, you know, just watching them play, you really don't get to know the person that they are and how they're wired and what they're all about. So I think that's what really those phone calls and when they're on your campus, them getting to know you and you can explain, you know, what your culture is and what the expectations are. And I think it's important for them to know that and understand, you know, what are the things that, what's your program all about? What are the guys like? Am I like them? Did I feel comfortable there? And obviously have parents and the recruits spend time and get to know you better, learning about how coming to your program will impact them. And is this the best place for them? And then vice versa. You want kids who love your school and families as well, but you also want it to be a great fit. It's not good for anybody if it's not a good fit. So being open and honest and transparent and having those conversations. And I think so much of the evaluations are done, but there's a lot more that happens once the communication starts that I think allows a coach to go, I really felt comfortable with that young man and their family. I really felt a great connection and just felt like, man, he is a good fit. And you really don't know until September 1 hits or later. And again, and just so we can help some of these guys with the anxiety, if you don't hear September 1st, don't give up hope. There will be guys that will be great players, some of the best players in your class that will blossom late. It happens every year.
So we'll come back to a couple of the points that you just hit on, but I referenced a few minutes ago wanting to get your sense or thoughts on the value of the social aspect of the sidelines at these summer events. And the reason I want to ask is because, as I mentioned, I had a conversation in July with one of your rival, an assistant at one of your rival programs, and he made a comment that really kind of reframed things for me, because I think that, you know, the you talk to a parent or a club coach and about the idea of evaluators sitting on a sideline and they're either on their phone the whole time or they're telling jokes to each other the whole time and they're not really paying attention. And sometimes it comes across derisively. I think that there's another point of view where it's kind of needed. It's a needed sanity check in order to not just have the monotony of, you know, having your eyes bleed staring at a sun-drenched field all day. But what this coach referenced to me is that, like, he made it seem as though that's part of the job. And he was like, yeah, I watched Hills, and he's, you know, he's either watching and he's taking notes or he's constantly talking to people. And the talking to people is part of the job. And it doesn't matter whether it's information sharing or relationship development or whatever the case may be. How do you regard it? How do you regard the social aspect of the sidelines?
Well, we're all kind of having a shared experience. You know, everybody is on the road. It's hot. It's hot for the players. It's hot for the families. It's hot on the sidelines. So, and you're sitting there a lot of times. You're getting there maybe at 7:30 if the first game's at 8. You know, you got to check in. A lot of times, you know, you could be there until 6 at night. Could be later. Could be a little less. But it's a lot of time. So, again, by going to multiple events, I think it allows you to have some moments where you just know you got to build in. You're going to be distracted. Maybe there's a problem at home. Maybe one of your players needs something. Your boss could call. It could be a number of things. So you could get distracted and miss part of a game or, you know, part of the day. So again, with multiple opportunities to watch, it allows you that. Same thing with, you know, inevitably, those days are long. So I think there's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of fun that you can have, and you want to try to have some fun with it, right? It's same thing. We're going to work long hours during the year. You want to have fun with your kids. You're certainly trying to get better, but you got to add some humor to it, at least in my opinion, and enjoy it. And part of that banter is coaches just, you know, teasing each other a little bit. You know, it's like, you know, you go back and forth and you know, it could be about anything. Again, part of that helps you get through the day because it is hot. Those days are long. But you also get to see a lot of guys that only kind of understand what we do because they do it and they're in it. The hours you put in, realizing that, you know, when you're working with 18 to 22-year-olds or so, there are some, like, challenging moments. So you can kind of help each other through, ask for advice about things, you know, hey, how'd you handle that situation? It could be about job openings you know, guys asking you, hey, what do you know about this guy? He seems like a really good coach. I have an opening. You could talk about that. Certainly having been on the rules committee, there was always a lot of talk about that. And you welcomed it because for me, I worked for the coaches. That's the way I looked at it. And we never wanted as a committee to just go, we're this rogue group and we're just going to make random decisions. You're able to kind of feel people out and see what they're passionate about. So how are you feeling? And you're taking a little bit of a straw poll. You're just kind of getting some information, but then, you know, surveys go out and you get some raw data. But there's a lot of things that do happen. You know, and what also is kind of fun is, you know, you'll see former players that will maybe even be coaching other teams. So it's great to connect with them. You'll see former teammates or former players with their sons playing now. So you get to connect with them and maybe go out to dinner with them, or you go out to dinner with either college coaches, club coaches, or friends or family. So there are some other things that, like, you're doing as well. So I'm not sure people really realize that, but those are things that we're doing. And again, some of that camaraderie and the fun and busting each other's chops, it does help you get through. Those days are hot. And it is, those are long, long days. And you know, you're trying to drink as much water as you can, but it is hot out there, and you know, it's hot for the kids, it's hot for everybody, and so a little humor goes a long way.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit more about roster construction and then a little bit about program identity. And so, you know, one of the elements of this that I'm really curious about is, and you know, there's some stuff that's actually like being proposed about, you know, potentially changing now. I'm not even sure the extent to which it's prudent to get into any of it because of how in flux it is. But at least in terms of looking back over the last 4 to 5 years, you know, certainly the advent of the transfer portal and the additional year of eligibility for everybody, but specifically players in the Ivy League who weren't able to take their grad year at their undergraduate institution, I would imagine really changed the approach to roster construction, and that had a trickle-down effect on recruiting. How do you describe that effect?
Yeah, the you know, obviously with the pandemic, there were a lot of things that, you know, all of a sudden got, you know, just changed. And we were all kind of wondering what the NCAA would do with that 2020 year. If you were a senior, and we had a smaller senior group that year, what's going to happen? Would those guys get another year? Was that the end of the road? And I'll just use Jared Bernhardt, for example. You know, that was his true senior year. And among all the other seniors, you know, we were halfway through, we were getting ready to play Virginia, and it was the week of Virginia that things ended, and you were like, geez, like, this is it? Like, this is the last game, this class is, you know, the game before was the last game that we're going to play. And then the other, then you started hearing, well, they might get a year, and then when you found out that everybody was getting a year, another year, you just wondered what were the unintended consequences. And the NCAA was in a tough spot, right? What do you do? You know, you want to be fair to kids. I do think the easiest answer would have been, listen, we're sorry. It's a pandemic. You know, people have lost lives. They lost family members. We're just going on to 21. We're sorry you didn't get to finish out your career, but there are people hurting on such higher levels above and beyond playing lacrosse. And we realized, you know, the kids are really passionate about lacrosse, but that would have been the most simple thing. And then we could have just moved forward doing what we've always done, but they made decisions and decisions get made, and you just have to deal with the consequences. And then I think as a program, you had to kind of figure out what worked best for you. And each program is different and unique. Each program has different philosophies and, you know, pillars and beliefs. And you had to figure out what worked best for you. And then on top of that, well, did you have limitations on your roster? Some of us have roster caps. We've been capped at 50. So with the ability of the transfer portal and bring in all these guys, for us, we still had to stay under our number. So you had to kind of figure out how you wanted to do it. And so for us, we felt like there was a balance between, you know, adding a couple guys, but still staying with our core guys. And you know, that was kind of the way we approached it the first couple of years, is, you know, adding two, adding three, maybe adding three or four, whatever it may be, but not overhauling and going all in and maybe, you know, like 15 transfers or something like that. And there's nothing wrong with that if you feel like that is best for your program. Every coach has to decide what works best for them, and there's no right or wrong. You just have to figure out how you wanted to do it. But for us to stay under 50, we really, with all these guys committed and guys that are already in our program, we had to be strategic with what we've done and what we were going to do. If you wanted to go up to 60 or 70, you had that right. And if that, you felt like that worked best for you, you had a lot more wiggle room in terms of just adding more guys in. But it's not as easy as just having more guys. I do think when the more guys you add, you're just, there are more there's more stresses to other part of your program, right? Your academic advisor has more advisees. You have more guys in the weight room. You know, your positional groups get bigger. So I do think there is a balance to, you know, making sure those guys continue to get coached and they get the level of attention they need. And each guy, I think, needs his own individual attention. But there's a balance there. And I think each program, each staff had to kind of figure out what was best for them. And we didn't have a blueprint. You know, this is the first time for all of us to kind of go through this and figure out like how we wanted to do it. I think it was maybe a harder decision when you didn't have a roster limit, because you could just bring in a ton of guys if you wanted to. If you had a cap, it kind of made your decision for you. So it made it a little bit easier. And then you kind of had to figure out the guys you were bringing in. You already had a captive audience and guys that had been in there. I think it's important that the guys coming in were like-minded to the players you already had. And, you know, if you're trying to build chemistry, having like-minded guys and guys that had similar values, I think there's a lot of importance to that. At least we felt that way, to try to make sure your chemistry wasn't impacted by just randomly grab players. I don't think most programs did that. I don't think they just, hey, he's good, let's just take him. I think most people, you know, vet that, and they try to do a little bit more homework on the guys bringing in just to make sure that the culture is good and the chemistry and the guys got along in your locker room.
Yeah. So just to kind of drill down a little bit more specifically on some of the points you just made. So in the 22 class, which was the group that you recruited in the fall of 2020, you brought in 12 guys. And then in the 23s, you brought in 8 guys. And then in the 24s, you were going to bring in 12. Was the smaller class in 23 kind of intentionally about trying to create a little bit more room for flexibility? Should there be opportunities to bring in transfers, be they grad students or undergrads, that maybe you hadn't factored in because of the way that some of the things that unfolded in 20 and 21 worked out?
Definitely. And one thing I would add, which, you know, we didn't talk about, but was really impactful was, you know, like we had more guys that were in our program that wanted to do the extra year than we had guys coming in. And that is a dynamic a lot of people didn't really understand, is you, especially if you had a roster cap, you know, you were put in a position that you've had guys in your program for 4 years, and then you had to make a decision like, could you extend them a fifth year? Like, did you have room with all these guys committed? And if you didn't have wiggle room on your roster, and a lot of times you have that roster cap because of a Title IX and, you know, the university trying to stay within the balance. So totally understanding that and respecting that, you had to tell guys, you know, A, they couldn't come back potentially, or they could come back, but you don't have scholarship money for them. So now you're trying to figure out, and I think that was really for us trying to figure out, well, we have some kids that lost a year, they can use it. It would be a shame if they played their fifth year somewhere else when we have such a connection with them and such an affinity for them, and we love those guys and want to be back. And I think there are more of those guys than there are the transfers going to each school. So that was really hard. And so even with us in 22, with a number of those guys coming back, the Roman Puglisi's of the world, the Jake Higgins of the world, the Matt Rahills of the world, there were a lot of guys who wanted to come back to use that extra year. We had some guys that we had already guys committed. So we did have a few guys elect to do a post-grad year. And then we pushed them back to that 22 class, which I think was 12, but originally I think was 8 or 9. And by those guys pushing back from 21 to 22, that gave us some flexibility in 22. And then also it bulked up that 22 high school recruiting class for us. And I thought there was a benefit to them for doing that, because if all these guys are getting the extra year, or guys had reclassed in high school, if you had not reclassed or done an extra year, you were on the younger side trying to compete with guys that potentially were 5 years older than you, maybe 6. if you were like one of those guys that were 17 going into college. So that was something that I think in some cases guys did. They did a PG year to get older so that when they walked in the door, they were a little bit more prepared. And I think that happened sometimes by the suggestion of the coaches, but I do think families kind of saw that everybody got an extra year and they thought to themselves, hey, maybe we're on the younger side, or we see all these guys getting an extra year. My son, that's not necessarily a fair fight. We're going to get them an extra post-grad year. And if that made sense for the family, you saw people doing that. And I'm not sure people really realize that as well. And again, going back to some of the unintended consequences, I'm happy that those guys in 20 did get that extra year. I am glad for those guys. And, you know, obviously to have, you know, a number of those guys back. And I think, you know, two guys that stick out that came back in 21 and had great years were Nick Grill and Jared Bernhardt. You know, they came back from the 20 year and then 21 year and had really good years. And I was excited for them and for all the other guys that were 2020 grads that played in any program or any sport. You were happy to see them get a full year. But man, the challenges of the next 3 years became difficult. And I do feel for some of the high school players that if we weren't taking as many to stay within our roster cap, there weren't as many homes, that certainly at the Division I level. Not that Division I's the end-all be-all. There are great places to play in Division II and Division III as well, great places and great experiences. But it did seem like there weren't as many spots for some of those players to go, and there are more kids playing than ever and more great players than ever.
How do you and your staff plan for natural attrition, whether it be a player who decides that he doesn't want to play college lacrosse anymore, a player whose injury status he just can't recover from, or a player who decides that Maryland's not the fit for him, or you guys, and you kind of referenced this previously, you know, have a conversation and come to an agreement that, you know, maybe Maryland's not the best fit. Because you said, you know, you previously said, right, if it's not the right fit, it's not the right fit for everybody. How do you plan and prepare and kind of execute through that as those situations develop?
Yeah, you know, life is not a straight line. You know, there are lots of curves, and you mentioned a number of reasons. You think that when a young guy comes on campus, you know, you're always optimistic that it's going to be a great experience, and, you know, things are going to work out well. But with 50 guys on a roster, it's inevitable that there will be some things that maybe you didn't expect. You know, you mentioned injuries. You know, we've had guys, multiple ACLs, and, you know, a lot of times guys do come back from injuries, but sometimes they don't come back the same, or maybe guys have concussions. Guys change their mind. You know, they're human beings. Sometimes you get to a school and other things become more important. There are sometimes family dynamics and things like that change. Maybe guys want to get closer to home. There are a lot of things that you don't necessarily expect, but it's almost inevitable that to a certain extent, there'll be some of that. And so at the end of the day, you know, especially being an older coach, you want the players in your locker room to be happy. Like, you want them to feel like this is the right place for them. And that can change, and for a variety of reasons. And I think, at least in our program with our coaches, if a young man changes his mind and feels like, whether it's, hey, I'm not as passionate about the place, or I'm not as passionate about playing lacrosse, hey, I need to get closer to home, I've changed my major, whatever it may be, I personally don't want anybody to ever feel obligated to be here. I just don't. Like, I wouldn't want that. I feel like this is their 4 years. This is their opportunity. So if there's a place that they feel like they would be happier, they could be more successful, they need to do it. And I don't buy into that you owe us something. Hey, you signed a contract. People change their mind. Things change. We're imperfect people. So our hope is that even though maybe at times, like, they're going through a tough time, or they're not as playing as well as they'd like, or as much as they'd like, or They're just dealing with some adversity. Maybe they're out for the year because of an injury. Even though that's hard and they're not happy about it, deep down inside, they're like, this is not really what I wanted, but it's still the right place for me. And sometimes, you know, for a variety of reasons, whether, you know, you're just kind of down in the dumps or, you know, for a lot of reasons, you can question that. I don't think there's anything wrong with questioning that. Yet, if something does change, hey, if you find a better place and you're going to be happier, like, you need to do it. And again, that's just my take on it. And things change and people do change. And like I said, this is not a job. It's, you know, an opportunity to get an education, build friendships, pursue something you're really passionate about. And people do change their minds, and it happens. But if you have everybody walking in that door that are totally locked in and super passionate, to me, that's better than having some guys kind of questioning how much they want to be here, because they're not going to be as invested. They're not going to have that passion and energy, you know, like, they're more going to kind of take energy than give energy. And who wins there? I don't think anybody does.
You open a door that I want to walk through. It's not a job. And the proposed house settlement is very clearly not going to make it a job. However, it is going to both allow schools to compensate athletes directly, as well as potentially put into place a number of other, rules. I don't know. I don't even know if that's the right word for it, but certainly there is no right word for it because it's just a proposal and there's a lot more work to be done on it. But with that being said, has there been any internal communication within the department about, hey, just, you know, be aware, this might be something that you should kind of take the time to prepare for? Or has it been, it's still an ongoing situation and there's nothing to report right now?
Yeah, that's the latter. I think all departments right now, just talking to some of my peers, everybody's trying to wrap their arms around this and figure out, where do we go if everything happens? You know, if this thing goes through, how do we respond? And again, I think the administrations there's a lot to consider. You know, there are a lot of sports teams that are going to be impacted. So it's not easy. So I get it. It's a balancing act, you know, as an athletic administrator, ADs, et cetera. What do you do here? You know, there's a lot of choices you can make in terms of, do you increase, you know, financial support or support in general, or do you increase or decrease the number of teams that are competing at your university? These are, I think, at every school, like, these are not taken lightly. I don't think anybody goes into this thinking, hey, we're going to not fund you as much, we're not going to support you as much, or maybe drop sports and enjoys it. Like, that is the hardest thing I think that an athletic administrator can do, is taking away an opportunity, or you know, seeing your athletes not supported at the level you'd like to support them. So it's going to be challenging. And I think, you know, the more time they get, the better. But also, yeah, I'd be lying if I think most coaches in all sports aren't a little concerned about, hey, how does this impact our lives and our programs? And then once we find out, like, how do we move forward? So, again, I think we learned during COVID, you got to be flexible, and you got to be ready to pivot and adjust. And if we've learned anything in the last 5 years or so, you know, the ability to do that is paramount. It's something that I think you can teach your players, is the world is rapidly changing, and you have to be able to adjust to what's happening to be successful. And the better you do at that, and the more nimble you are, the more successful you can be.
All right, two more, and then I'll let you get on with your day. A big one and a fun one. The big one is, how do you define the identity of your program?
For me, I feel like I'm very lucky. The three words, be the best. Like, I never have to, at this time of year, going, all right, what are we putting on the shirts? What are we putting on the wall? I really do feel lucky. Bud Beardmore, who really coined that phrase and originated the concept of be the best version of yourself. It doesn't mean we have to be the best lacrosse team and rank number one every year. It's really more for each player to be the best person, student, and player they can be in that order. And so that does not, you got to find the right guy that really wants to subscribe to that. Because it's human nature to kind of have your days where you're off, you don't feel like doing it, and or you have some success and you relax. It's really atypical to find somebody that has that extreme level of competitiveness and that growth mindset that whatever they're doing, they want more. They want to push harder, and they're not satisfied. And that, I think that's hard to find. So really, that's our identity. That's what we try to have our identity be. There have been some times where we've been better and worse at that, but that's the nature of working with young people and being with a team is some weeks you're going to play better than others, some quarters as well. And that's the challenge of when you're not doing well, figuring out how do we get the wheels back on the road and where can we improve, whether it's from an individual or a team concept or also schematics, things of that nature. And I think that's why people love coaching and teaching is there's always challenges. The game changes, the circumstances change, kids, what they're dealing with changes. So you're always having to evolve and improve and adjust and challenge yourself. And at times it can be really rewarding, especially when you see a young guy go through a tough time and see them come out the other side better, or they come in as a wide-eyed freshman and they walk out this really mature guy ready to take on the world and have a great career and be a great dad and husband. So I think that identity, be the best, is really, I am fortunate, does give me an out on this question, but it is what we believe in. It really is. So I feel lucky because we don't have to sit in a room and go, all right, well, based on this year, what do we want to do? It's like, nope, this is what we do. This is how we do it. And sitting in this chair, as long as I'm here, that's what I'll try to do. And the hope is that whoever has the chair next, they will do the same. And we just keep it going. But I'm thankful for the be the best, because it just makes everything clear and easy when you're trying to explain that to a family and a recruit. Hey, this is what we do. This is what we're about. It's pretty simple.
I ask because this time of year, I get, you know, asked by a lot of parents about, hey, what, you know, what's this school like? What's this coach like or whatever? And, you know, I think that you can start from either pole in terms of, you know, these experiences are actually way more similar than they are different, or the opposite, you know, pole. And it depends on, you know, kind of what you want to accomplish in the conversation. But, you know, I tend to try to point out the distinctions between programs and between personalities and leaders. And, you know, for me, what I've settled on over the last couple of years, and I don't think that it's coincidental that as a result, or not as a result, but I don't think it's coincidental that Maryland has produced more pro lacrosse players than any other program. But, you know, what I have kind of defaulted to saying is that, you know, if your child wants the experience of what it would be like to be a pro lacrosse player, and what I mean by that is, you know, as a PLL or an NLL player, you don't live in the market with your team, and you don't practice 4 or 5 days a week in order to get ready to play on Saturday or Sunday the way you do as a pro football, basketball, soccer, hockey, whatever. So as a result, like, if you want to emulate that experience, I think that relative to your peers, doing so at Maryland is the closest that you're going to get. How does that strike your ear, and how close is that to the notion of be the best?
Well, I think there's a balance. Again, I think the be the best as a player, I think, does help set you up for pro lacrosse. Just because if you're trying to maximize your potential, that means squeezing out as much potential as a player as you can be. Where I do think that helps when you're talking about pro lacrosse, if you are a guy with a growth mindset and you're trying to be the best version of yourself, you're not satisfied. You are trying to, if you're a midfielder, you know, you're working on, you know, playing offense, playing defense, and picking up ground balls, like you name it, anything that falls under the category of a midfielder, you're challenging yourself to do. If you are a PLL coach and general manager, you have a 19-man roster, finding guys with diverse skill sets, you know, guys that can do a multitude of things are beneficial. And I'll look at a guy like Jack Corris, who was a great player for us, did so much for us, did not get drafted, And I had a lot of conversations with coaches before the draft, and certainly I'm very biased about who Jack Corse is as a person and what he did as a player, and who he is as a human being. So I'm biased. I totally get it. But there were other guys that had more accolades. I balanced and said, listen, this is my bias. This is what I see. And again, gave him a strong endorsement, but also realized those guys need to bring in players that fit what they're looking for. But I felt like Jack was a guy that bought into the be the best mindset. His freshman year, we thought we might use him at defense, so he learned the defense. You know, we moved him back to offense. He played wings on faceoffs for us. He played man up for us. He's done a little bit of everything. And we talk a lot about the more things you can do and the more you're willing to be uncomfortable and challenge yourself and improve, yeah, the better you're going to be, which is not, again, human nature is to be comfortable. You know, it's not to try to work on your offhand and look like average, you know, when you first start doing it as a younger player. You know, you want to look good. So what do? You do the things you're comfortable and you feel like are strengths. You don't, hey, I'm going to work on this in front of my peers and look bad. Like, no one wants to do that. But you're looking for that atypical guy that is like thinking long term, if I keep investing in this, I'll get better. So, you know, when, you know, I talked to Coach Stagnita after the draft and he was looking, you know, to grab somebody, it just seemed like what he was looking for was a guy that could do all those things. And obviously Jack has just done a tremendous job this summer. And so that will be a guy I will talk about going forward, just because Jack always was willing to do whatever the team needed to help the team. He was never afraid to take on challenges or, you know, kind of look vulnerable because he was doing something he wasn't good at. He was like, hey, if that's what the team needs, I'll do it. And sometimes that's really hard. I think it's hard for anybody. But a guy like Nick Manis was the same way. You know, Nick was a really good player for us. We looked at giving him a pole during his career, and then we moved him back to short stick. But by the end of it, he was playing short stick and long stick on man down. And I thought he was a guy that played in pro lacrosse, A, because he was a good player. But again, small rosters, now you have a guy that can play long stick and short stick. Very valuable. So I do think with being the best, that mantra does lend itself to the PLL. But we look at the same thing academically and then as a human being, like, we're not going to be like, you shouldn't be the same person coming out of here as you were coming in. So we do want to challenge you. You know, we want you to grow as a person. We want you to take classes in all different areas to expose yourself to what's out there. So that when you get in a conversation with anybody, whether it's at work or family or friends, you will have something to say. You can participate in that conversation. You're not ignorant. So we make sure that we try to make our guys understand what's going on in the world. And we talk about those things because the worst thing that can happen, right, is you get after graduation, you're talking to some people and you really can't relate to the conversation and you feel like just a little insecure because you can't add anything to that. So again, that be the best is really something that I feel like it's hard to take that on every day and it's not for everybody, but it's not for our benefit. It really is for the benefit of the guys that we coach and serve every day. They'll walk out of here, I think, more prepared in their jobs, kind of a little bit better understanding in certain cases of like what's happening in the world, being able to troubleshoot, you know, fix problems, find solutions, things like that. To me, that's our job. It's not just play lacrosse and go to class. There's so much more, I think, that so many of us do in all the different sports. And we take the development of these young people really seriously. And we realize what our coaches did for us. And having been at the Naval Academy, you know, for 12 years, I saw, you know, what they did to develop leaders of character. And it wasn't just about lacrosse. So a lot of the things that we do, certainly all the coaches have broad ideas, but a lot of it goes back to the things I learned at the Naval Academy. And right, these guys are going to be leading people and lives are going to be at stake. And, you know, you had to take that seriously when you were there and realize you were under more scrutiny as a leader. You had to make sure you did a good job. Because these guys were going to make really important decisions. well, why can't you do a lot of those same things at a civilian institution? You want your kids to be really successful in the corporate world there as coaches or as lawyers or doctors or whatever they want to pursue. So the more you push and challenge them, the better they're going to be. But you also realize they're young people. They need to have fun. And, you know, they got to balance what they're doing, because if it's not fun, they're going to burn out. If you work them too hard, they're going to burn out. So you got to find that sweet spot where they are challenged, but also they can catch their breath and enjoy it. But I do think it is a lot of hard work.
So like I mentioned, last one, I think there's an opportunity for this to be a little fun. Obviously, one of the things that's interesting about the way you talk about the program, particularly after games, is you refer to the state and playing with pride for the state. And obviously, that's represented on the roster as well. And then, you know, certainly there have been a lot of great players that have come through the program from Philadelphia. You know, a handful have come through from Central New York, which obviously is a place that you're very familiar with. But it'd be hard not to notice how many guys from Atlanta have contributed to your program in recent years. And that's true for this year's roster as well. And you get to play at Bobby Dodd Stadium, the home of Georgia Tech football. It's a rematch of the national championship. Can you talk about the program's relationship to Atlanta and how exciting it is to play in the historic venue?
Yeah, super excited. You know, we had talked about last year playing Notre Dame neutral site. One of the things that the reason for that is, right now, back-to-back weekends, Notre Dame plays Georgetown, then Maryland, and right now they play us. They play back-to-back home games against those teams. And then, you know, if we didn't change it for this year, they'd be coming to Georgetown, and then next week coming right back to Maryland. So talking to Coach Corrigan, there was a desire to kind of get off that. And so we did talk about neutral site, and we looked at some places last year, and it just didn't work out. And then, you know, we were kind of investigating some places, and Atlanta came to mind. A friend of mine, Jason Breo, who plays with our team, the Sail and Shoe up in Lake Placid, he ran an event last year with Army and UMass. And in talking to Joel Barisi, he said it was a wonderful experience. I've known Jason a long time, and I think after some conversations with Coach Corrigan and myself, and Jason, you know, Kevin and I just felt like, man, this could be really awesome. And then we just lucked out. We had enough connections down there with Georgia Tech. My old sports supervisor, John Palumbo, is working at Georgia Tech now. He oversaw our program for a number of years. So there was a little bit of background there, and with a number of other members of their administration as well. So there was a chance that maybe we could play at Bobby Dodd Stadium. And I think anybody that's familiar with Atlanta and college football and what that place means, I think everybody is super excited. So what an awesome opportunity to play in an iconic venue. And for us, yeah, we've had some really good ones from Atlanta. So to me, it was great. We have some alums down there. Mac Pons is down there. He and his dad, they're very involved with some club programs down there and some youth programs. So it's kind of natural. We look at all places around the country, but it just seems like Atlanta's been a good one for us. So couldn't be more excited to get down there. And again, just have our guys play in a different area. Certainly for Braden Irksa to get back you know, have him be able to play in front of a lot of his local friends and family. Ryan Siracusa, who just played for us, had an awesome year for us last year. The last 2 years, he's been a huge contributor on game day, but was a really important five-year guy for us. So I'm sorry we didn't get down there just a year sooner, because I know it would have been great for him, because we're certainly grateful for what he's done for us.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Coach Tillman, really appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Best of luck as you hopefully find a few more days. I know you got an opportunity for some R&R around Lake Placid, but hopefully there's a few more days before the boys come back to town. And when they do, enjoy it, because I know that means that it's time to shift into gear. As you said, the fall brings a lot. It brings a lot of volume, it brings a lot of challenges, and it brings a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think the start to the year I think it's something everybody looks forward to. I know some of our guys have already talked about, you know, the excitement of coming back. And I always feel like that's a good sign, you know, that they're excited to come back. I think getting home is really important after the year. But then you start to get that itch. And then I think any campus that you go on in the fall, those move-in days for all the freshmen on the campus, you can feel that energy of these young people that are starting their journey. And then for the people coming back, having new roles in your program and the excitement of what's going to happen this year. And there's a lot of excitement and it's a lot of fun. You got to start all over. And again, you lose great players. Certainly we lost some really good players, but you know, there are guys that are waiting in the wings to have their opportunity, just like the guys who graduated last year kind of were waiting for their opportunity. So at a place like Maryland, you're always going to lose really important and really good players, but you know that there are guys waiting in the wings for their chance to go out and grab something and, you know, make that opportunity their own and maximize it. So it is a lot of fun, and it's fun to see your peers on campus and a lot of your staff that maybe you haven't seen a lot since May.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.